WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ernest Hemingway once said, all modern American literature came from one book, Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn. When it comes to modern American music, the same kudo often goes to a set of recordings called the Hot Fives and Sevens, led by the great Louis Armstrong. Recorded between 1925 and 1928, these 60-plus songs have been called the Rosetta Stone of jazz music. Although Armstrong was already an established and popular sideman, playing with band leaders King Oliver and Fletcher Henderson, and along blues singers such as Bessie Smith, the Hot Fives and Sevens was his debut as a band leader himself. Recorded in the Chicago studios of OK Records, Hot Fives and Sevens came to be heard as the genesis of improvisational jazz. Tonight we look at how one revolutionary set of recordings would break open the worlds of jazz, pop, blues, country, even classical music that followed. Can we still hear the genius today, the joyful rebellion of Louis Armstrong stepping out? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me now from New York City is Gary Giddens, a columnist for The Village Voice and author of Satchmo, The Genius of Louis Armstrong, and Bing Crosby, A Pocket Full of Dreams. Good evening and welcome, Gary Giddens.
Good evening.
Hi, thanks for being with us.
Sure.
Gary Giddens, we're listening to Hot Fives and Hot Sevens tonight, and Louis Armstrong bringing American music to a kind of pivot point. Place this in history for us, in musical history first. What was the change that this series of recordings announced to the world?
Well, first thing I have to tell you, I can barely hear you over the music. Is there any way to adjust that?
I have no doubt we can fix that and will in a hurry.
Okay. What did the Hot Fives and Hot Sevens bring to music?
Yeah.
Well, before, jazz was essentially a polyphonic music, and I think you could even say in some respects it was a folk music in that it came from a specific community. It addressed certain functions of that community, and it was played in a way that was traditional and did not necessarily require in any conventional sense, virtuosity. In that sense, it's very much like most popular musics, from you know, country fiddling to rock and roll. It was a music that competent musicians could join in and learn to play. It was as much a craft as anything else. But Louis Armstrong turned it into an art. He took it away from its folk beginnings, and he gave it a stature, a musical profundity that allowed it to really conquer the world in a way that no music ever quite had. I mean, not even 19th century European classical music reached as many corners of the world as jazz did between the 20s and the 40s, and this was almost exclusively because of the impact of Armstrong.
Did he know, did people following music at the time know what was happening here, what they were hearing, what it represented?
Unquestionably. The general public didn't know, and didn't know for decades to come. I mean, most Americans, for example, thought of Louis Armstrong as an extremely engaging performer. They loved watching him on Ed Sullivan and other variety television shows of the 50s and 60s. He was hugely popular. He sold millions and millions of records. But in terms of being a great, serious figure in American music, I think musicians knew it. Unquestionably, there were some critics who knew it. I would say that there were probably more critics and scholars of music in Europe who picked up on what Armstrong was doing than in the United States. You have to remember that when Armstrong came along, there had been a call, as there had been in the 19th century by Emerson and the other New England mandarins for an American literature. There was now a call for an American music, and the American intellectuals and academics were looking to the Academy to find that music. They were looking to people like Charles Ives, who certainly is a great figure in American music, but they certainly weren't expecting it from a young black kid, really, from New Orleans, who was unlettered, uneducated, and was creating something that had really no precedent, certainly in the Academy and in many respects in any of music. I mean, he really is, he really does spring from the head of Zeus. What he does changes everything.
Gary Gittins, I know how well you know that milieu and we want to talk about it, but I want to be sure first that we hear and understand the difference. We've got a cut here from King Oliver's Creole jazz band called Chimes Blues. I think Louis Armstrong actually played with King Oliver. This is, I'm told this is sort of the before. We want to put it up against, I think we're going to listen to Potato Head Blues.
Okay.
Describe the change, the difference for us.
This is King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band in 1923. Armstrong came up to play with Oliver, and there was a sideman. And what's fascinating about this record is, like many rag-influenced jazz pieces, it has several themes, three major themes. And the third theme, the trio, is given over to Armstrong himself. Now, you will note he plays this theme twice. It's just a 12-bar blues theme. He doesn't improvise at all. It's completely written out. And yet the sound of Armstrong's trumpet, the phrasing, the implicit swing, it's like a door opening into the future. It's so different from everything else on this rather conventional polyphonic rag-influenced performance.
Let's listen just a minute to King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band with Louis Armstrong playing the pre-Hot Fives and Heights Hot Sevens Chimes Blues. So there it is.
Wait, here comes Armstrong.
Oh, let's listen right now.
Chimes.
All right, let's listen. So we hear Gary Gittins there. You've got the old plunk, 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 and into it comes this this free trumpet or cornet. But still, it's in that old deliberate context. I want to listen now just to a bit of Potato Head Blues to listen side by side, and then have you talk us through the step ahead that Potato Head Blues represents. Here's Louis Armstrong in
I was just going to say, it drives me crazy to hear him called Louis. He used to say, white folks always call me Louis, they must think I'm French. He really did prefer to be called Louis.
We'll give him Louis,
and
so it is. Louis Armstrong in Hot Fives and Sevens, Potato Head Blues. There's Hot Fives and Hot Sevens, and Louis Armstrong, of course, playing that trumpet, or I guess that cornet. Gary Gittins, we heard them both back-to-back. There's King Oliver, and then on into the new dawn with Hot Fives and Hot Sevens. What's the advance? What's the stride ahead here, Louis Armstrong pulling music forward?
Man, on every level. First of all, there's the brilliance of his sound. Nobody had ever played the trumpet like that. It's so personal. There's so much magnetism and might behind it.
It feels organic, not at all mechanical.
Never. Then there's the genius for the blues. I mean, the blues was always there, but in a lot of circles, especially in New York, a lot of people thought the blues might be a fad, like ragtime itself, and that it would just fade away. Armstrong showed that the blues was the essential tonality in American music, and that it would last forever. And he showed why it would last forever, because he gave it the profundity it required and inspired in him. Then there's the whole the rhythm, the time. He's the first musician who really swings in a modern sense. Before Armstrong, people are playing two-beat rhythms. They're often accenting on the one and three in the march tradition, or even when they're playing on the two, it's in a very, as you said, chomp, chomp, chomp kind of rhythm. Armstrong just floats over the beat. He has complete command, total control, and he's always really genuinely improvising, and nothing ties him down. You know, jazz could really not have developed the way it did before the recording technology was available. And one of the things that Armstrong teaches us is that a musician of genius can improvise a variation, and 70 years later, it's as timeless as the written variations of the Bach.
It sure is.
Because it has that quality to it, and people would not have believed that then.
Was he lonely in doing that, or did this great crew that he was playing with, were they right there with him, ready to take that step forward?
You know, it's a little bit like the 4-minute mile, which nobody could do, and then one guy ran it, and weeks later, everybody in the world was doing it. Very quickly, people who understood Armstrong, and he had followers almost instantly. I mean, you had guys who had been listening to him even before these records were made. But Big Spiderbeck showed that a white player could bring a tremendous personal individuality and distinction to this music, and still following in Armstrong's footsteps. Coleman Hawkins was doing it on tenor saxophone. The important thing here is it's not just trumpet players. I mean, Don Redman, who was the great arranger in New York for the Fletcher Henderson Band, said as soon as he heard Armstrong playing, he changed his whole orchestration style. And perhaps the most significant influence was on Duke Ellington. If you listen to Ellington's pre-Hot 5 records, they're not particularly distinguished. They don't swing, and they don't have a blues tonality. And then, after he hears Armstrong, he realizes what's missing from his music, and he hooks up with a Armstrong and Oliver-influenced trumpet player named Bubber Miley, and then he gets a real Armstrong, acolyte in Cootie Williams, and suddenly Ellington is just completely liberated, and his genius becomes very evident.
Was Ellington acknowledging the Louis Armstrong link at the time? Was it conscious?
Oh, I think everyone did. I don't think there's any question about it. The classic story is that he goes to New York in 1924 to play with Henderson, and everybody treats him as a rube because he comes from the South and he's dressed it, and can he read, and he doesn't have the sophistication. All of these black musicians, these are the best musicians in New York in Henderson's band, but a lot of them have been to the academy, they've been to the university, they're very well educated, they know their music, and Armstrong plays, and suddenly they all feel like a bunch of chumps, and everybody starts changing their style.
We're going into a break here, Gary Giddens, with Muggles. Tell us about this piece.
This is an extraordinary record. This is the first record ever made, I believe, that is a string of solos. There's just one soloist after another, and of course, there are tens of thousands of jazz recordings that are strings of solos. But it begins here, and one of the interesting things about it is that the first two solos, this trombone solo you're hearing now and the clarinet that follows it, are very ordinary. They're not even particularly good by workmanlike standards of that period. But when you compare them with what Armstrong plays, right after this clarinet solo, Armstrong plays an astounding break, and he goes into a solo that you really should play through because it's one of the glorious moments.
Gary, let's listen and see if we can get it before the break. We're talking about Hot 5s and Hot 7s with Gary Giddens. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight we're talking about the music of Louis Armstrong's Hot Fives and Sevens. We're listening to a tune called Weatherbird, a sort of musical boxing match between Armstrong and the pianist Earl Hines. Our guest tonight is Gary Giddens. He's author of Satchmo, the Genius of Louis Armstrong. Gary Giddens, what's going on here in this piece, Weatherbird?
Well, the tune itself is it never seemed to be a particular interest until Armstrong and Earl Hines made this recording. Hines was often said back in the 20s to play trumpet-style piano, which means that he tried to play with the vivacity and the improvisational freedom and swing of Louis Armstrong on the keyboard, very different from the ragtime tradition that, for example, Lillian Hardin played in with Armstrong's Hot Five. And here's just the two of them. It's maybe to this day the greatest duet ever recorded in jazz. Certainly, I can't think of anything greater. And what happens is they try to trip each other up. It's really not fair to the record to be talking over it and to be hearing it in excerpt. But
we'll listen in the clear. Let's listen. Louis Armstrong and the great Earl Hines mixing it up in Weatherbird from the Hot Fives and Sevens recordings. Wow.
I've been listening to that record. It occurs to me now for almost 40 years, and it still makes me laugh. It's just amazing. They really, I mean, the asymmetrical phrasing that Hines does, throwing in chords when you don't expect it, Armstrong coming in a beat before or a beat after, the incredible dynamics he uses. It's just one of these amazing things. And then they come out together at the end with a beautiful high note.
It's unbelievable.
It really is.
Is this the equivalent of a buddy film, or was this a duel?
It's a very friendly duel. I think it's two master musicians just seeing how far they can go within the context of, you know, what is essentially a 3-minute record and getting it right on the first take.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. We're talking about the classic Hot Fives and Sevens of Louis Armstrong. What do you hear today in the Louis Armstrong of the 1920s? And can you understand why this music was considered shocking? Do you hear the blooming of jazz here? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Gary Giddens, give us the history of Louis Armstrong. Where did this, still in the 20s, very young man come from? What was the path that led him to the incredible group of musicians out of childhood and to the point where he's sitting with these guys playing this music?
Well, he was born in New Orleans in August of 1901. He came from the most violent and poverty-stricken area in New Orleans. It was so bad it was known as the battlefield. Most of the people he grew up with were prostitutes, pimps, gangsters, you know, cheap thugs for the most part. He used to say when he had a big hit with Mac the Knife that he could sing it with such passion because he grew up with those people in Mac the Knife. And he always said that it was his mother's influence, his mother's love, and I think also the fact that he had relatives in a much more a pastoral setting called a Boutte, New Orleans, and he used to go there occasionally on weekends. So for whatever reason, he sort of evaded the worst elements of that place, and He had genius, and there's really no way to explain that. We can't explain it with him any more than we can with Mozart, because by the time he's in his early teens, he starts on bugle, he goes to cornet, trumpet. He's playing with that magnificence that all the other musicians in town recognize. They all want him in their bands. He's playing the New Orleans parades. He's playing the picnics. He's doing everything he can. He lies about his age at one point so he can work on the Streckfa steamer lines, goes up and down the Mississippi when he's only 17. But he's very much stuck in that milieu. Fletcher Henderson came through with Ethel Waters, heard him and said, "You've got to come back with me to New York," and Armstrong wouldn't do it. He always said that nobody could have gotten him out of New Orleans except his idol, King Oliver, whose trumpet case he used to carry, who he always considered the great master.
How did King Oliver do it? How did he take him away?
Well, Oliver went to Chicago, and he started the Creole Jazz Band.
This was sort of following the great migration of
African-Americans
north from New Orleans to Chicago.
Exactly,
in the 20s.
Mm-hmm. In 1921. And then a year later, he telegrammed Armstrong that he had a position for him in the band, and Armstrong... You know, he said his mother made him a trout sandwich. He got on the train wearing a boxback coat and went up there and was terrified when he walked into the Lincoln Gardens and heard that band. He didn't think he was ready for them. At least that's the story. But, you know, as soon as they heard him, it was just everything just changed.
And only 4 years later, he's making these recordings.
Well, even before he's making these recordings, he's doing incredible things on records. He makes a series of records with Clarence Williams that have Sidney Bechet on soprano saxophone. And on those records, you can begin to hear, I mean, these are probably the two greatest living soloists at that period, are Bechet and Armstrong. And for a while, Bechet was considered ahead. But by the end of that series of recordings, there's just no question who's in the lead here. And then he starts making, very prolifically, he records with a lot of blues singers, Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith and, maybe a dozen or two dozen more. He even made a record a couple of years later with Jimmy Rogers, the blue yodeler. He was just out there. And then in 24 also, he was with Henderson's band. And it's fascinating to listen to Henderson's recordings made before Armstrong joins the band, when he's with the band, after the band. It's a very academic-sounding unit. It doesn't swing. It's not really interesting to us. It sounds very old. And then Armstrong comes into it, and the ultimate result is it's the first genuine swing band.
It's a whole new world. Listeners, do you hear the young Armstrong as rebel, as pioneer? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Paul is on the line. Welcome, Paul. You're on the air.
How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
It's a really great show. I wanted to ask, you said a little bit about Sidney Bechet.
Just now, yes.
And basically, you know, made the point that I wanted you to make, so I'll ask another question. Miles Davis said at one point in his career, "You can't play anything that Louis Armstrong hasn't played on the trumpet, and that includes modern." I wish, sort of 2 points about that. I wish you'd talk a little bit about the influence of Armstrong carrying up through really avant-garde players like Davis. And then the other issue is the personality of Armstrong and somebody like Davis. Here you have two geniuses, you know, creatively.
But what different men?
Yes, well, I mean, that's the thing that really distinguishes Armstrong from, I think, most other artistic geniuses of the 20th century, which is he was a really genuinely decent human being.
Paul, those are both great. Gary, thanks for your call. Gary Giddens, first draw that line for us from Louis Armstrong in the 1920s right up to the avant-garde of 50s, 60s, jazz, and beyond that.
Up to the new century. You know, the important thing about jazz for most of its history, and there's some debate about whether it still exists today or not, but the great thing about jazz was that it interacted, it reflected the society. The music of the 30s could only have happened during the Depression. The post-war bebop thing could have only happened in those so-called noir years and so forth. Armstrong reflects the period. He reflects the minstrel influence was still very much alive. The comedians that he loved, the idea of the entertainer, the vaudevillian, the person who goes out on the stage, confronts the audience, is out there to entertain. He's an entertainer of genius, but that's what he's there to do. Miles Davis comes comes along after the war, when there are certain racial implications to entertainment, because, you know, a lot of young blacks are sick of being described as grinning. I remember the famous photographer Gordon Parks once said about Duke Ellington, Duke never grinned, he smiled, which is a phrase that you have to understand the way people wrote about these guys then to appreciate what he was trying to say.
But though Miles Davis gave so much credit to Louis Armstrong, Armstrong took heat for exactly becoming that kind of grinning icon in a way.
But as a musician, Miles quotes Armstrong frequently. Mm-hmm. He slows it down. He puts in dissonances. He has his own techniques, the way he bends notes without actually using the valves. I mean, all of these incredible Milesian contributions to the trumpet. But at the basis of it, he's still playing the blues, which Armstrong, you know, pinned to the lapel of this music, and he's still actually using phrases. He's still using concepts like playing in the three against four or rhythmically, which is something that Armstrong influenced. You can hear it in his scat solo on Hotter Than That.
Mm-hmm. Gary Giddens, you've written the bio on Louis Armstrong. What was the personality behind the persona? Here you've got Miles Davis, moody and dark. Louis Armstrong, the public persona, smiling, warm, out of the minstrel tradition, as you say. What was the man behind that?
Well, you know, I never heard anybody say anything ill about him. And when you're writing a biography, you pretty much have to go with what you get. And the general feeling about Armstrong is he was very much the way he seemed. He was certainly no pushover. I mean, he totally controlled his destiny and his life. He had very strong feelings about music, the way he presented himself. He didn't let people push him around at all. He was extremely generous. He was very witty. You can see that in all of his writings and his letters. There's wonderful one-liners. There's so many anecdotes that float around about, you know, Armstrong. Errol Garner used to love to tell about the knocking on Armstrong's dressing room door when they were playing a festival together, and he opened the door and said, "Hey, Pops, what's new?" And Louis said, "Nothing new. White folks still ahead." You know, he was an extraordinary man, geez. and he really loved to be out there performing. You just couldn't get him off the stage. I've written about this in my book, but when I was an undergraduate at a college in Iowa, I was able to bring Armstrong there for a concert one evening, and he was clearly, I mean, this was 1968, and he was clearly showing the effects of his age and of having been ill. But when he walked out on that stage, you would have thought he was auditioning for a gig. Wow. I mean, we were all just completely blown away by the amount of energy that he put into that performance.
And this is just a couple of 3 years before his death. You married Hotter, you mentioned Hotter Than That, Gary Giddens. Let's listen to a little bit. This is where Louis Armstrong begins to really cut loose the scat. Louis Armstrong bringing scat singing to a whole new plane in Hotter Than That from
and
the Hot Fives
and Johnson
Sevens.
On guitar.
And the little hello to rock and roll there in that guitar riff, that sounds like a harbinger if I ever heard one.
Well, the real rock and roll thing is when Lonnie Johnson takes his solo and he plays the entire thing in triplets. And this is basically, it sounds like it could have been the background for any 1950s doo-wop group that ever was.
What did people make when Louis Armstrong cut loose with that kind of scat? Was there precedent for it, or was this just, hey, I need another beer, I don't know what I'm hearing here?
No, it was the kind of thing that Armstrong had heard in New Orleans. He had done that. He'd started singing on street corners for pennies with other kids, but it had never been heard on recordings, and it really had never been heard out of New New Orleans for the most part. The first time he did it was a record called Heebie Jeebies. And, I mean, just everybody, just the jaws dropped. Mez Mezrau, in a book called Really the Blues, talks about guys used to greet each other on the streets by humming phrases from Heebie Jeebies at each other. Everybody just completely memorized that solo. But it took a couple of years. It was partly through Armstrong's friendship with Bing Crosby that he finally decided to record standard tunes. And lo and behold, Armstrong knew it all the time, but you know, Fletcher Henderson wouldn't let him sing. A lot of people with that gravelly voice just figured he's not a singer. But he turned out to be an incredible interpreter of songs, and everybody, even Rudy Valley, who was really a prehistoric figure and stylistically, wrote the introduction to a book that's somewhat credited to Armstrong, in which he talks about how everybody was influenced by Armstrong's phrasing. And by the mid-1930s, his voice is quite beautiful. I mean, you listen to him on records like Love Walked In, and nobody ever sang those things any better. And because he swings, and he's gorgeous.
And there's such joy in it. Gary Giddens, I want to go into the break listening to Tight Like This. Talk to us about the humor, the joy, the comedic element in this from Hot Fives and Sevens.
I can still remember the first time I played this record, and it still has the same effect on me. It starts out, the whole record is built around this rather risque, really adolescent joke, sex joke, in which one of the performers, I think it's Earl Hines, is in a falsetto voice, is pretending to be the woman, and he keeps saying, "Oh, Louie, it's tight like this." But at the same time, Armstrong plays this extraordinary, architectonic three-chorus solo. It's unlike anything he'd recorded before. Each chorus begins at a different range on the trumpet. First, you have like a bass, the lower notes, then the mid-range, then the high. One of the choruses actually begins with another risque joke, a quote from a World War I song. There is such beauty, and again, there's such magnificence to the solo, and it's within this context. So you really get the sense of, at the same time, of the highest kind of art married to the lowest form of humor.
There's mastery here. Let's sit back and listen. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Here's Tight Like This, Louis Armstrong. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight we're talking about the music of Louis Armstrong's epical 1920s recordings, Hot Fives and Sevens, with Armstrong biographer and Village Voice columnist Gary Giddens. Ezra Pound said the modern was all about making things new, and that was Louis Armstrong. This is St. James Infirmary, a song that highlights not only Armstrong's trumpet, but his trailblazing vocal talents.
I went down to St. James Infirmary, saw my baby there, stretched out on a long white table, so sweet, so cold, so fair. Let her go, God bless her. Wherever she may be, she can look this wide world over. She'll never find a sweet man like me. When I die, I want you to dress me in straight-leg shoes.
Louis Armstrong singing St. James Infirmary. We're talking tonight with Gary Giddens. He's a columnist for The Village Voice and author of Satchmo, The Genius of Louis Armstrong and Bing Crosby, A Pocket Full of Dreams. Gary Giddens, there's soul.
Yeah. Well, you know, Bing Crosby gave the best one-liner about Armstrong I've ever heard. He said, Louis Armstrong is the beginning and the end of music in America. And, you know, it doesn't really get any better. It doesn't get any more sophisticated or modern or moving or emotionally valid.
People say that this man has a place, should have a place right up there on the pedestal with Bach and Stravinsky and Duke Ellington.
Apparently he does, because Armstrong's recordings from that we're listening to from 1928, 76, they're all in print. They've never been out of print. They're probably played as much as the all but a handful of classical pieces that are contemporary with it. I mean, Stravinsky's ballets, clearly, Gershwin's symphonic pieces. But, you know, there hasn't been a lot of music that's come out of the Academy in the 20s and 30s that's performed today or that's really made the repertory. And Armstrong's music goes on and on. It's probably better known and better thought of today than it ever was during his lifetime. And I don't see any indication that it's about to disappear.
American music, American romance. Daniel's on the line. Welcome, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Gary Giddens.
Hi.
I have a couple quick questions. One, how much of his influence, early influence, was precisely due to the fact that he was on vinyl as an independent band leader with the Hot Five and Sevens? And quick question. Second question is, what did Hendrix and Torme have to say about him?
What did Hendrix and who?
Torme.
Male Torme.
And which Hendrix are we talking about?
The Scat.
John Hendrix?
John Hendrix.
Yeah, oh, John Hendrix, I talked to actually fairly recently. He called me up because he's teaching my Crosby book at a class at the University of Ohio, and he said that when he was growing up, there were only two singers that everybody was listening to for the scat who really knew how to do it, and that was Armstrong and Crosby. And you can especially hear the Armstrong influence in John when he sings ballads and his voice gets low when he uses, you know, the real heavy baritone quality of his range. Just in the phrasing, it's not the same voice, but the way he phrases is very much influenced. I don't really know what Mel Torme said on the record. I mean, clearly he's another jazz singer who the very fact that he scat sang as much as he did, the two, I think, essential influences on him in terms of scat would be Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald, who took it into a whole different place in the 1940s. What was the other?
Well, the other one, and Daniel, thank you for your call. The other question was, how much of Louis Armstrong's influence was due to the fact that he did get recorded? What was the recording world like then for someone like Louis Armstrong?
This is a good question, because the point of the Hot Fives and Sevens that should not be forgotten is that that band did not exist in the real world. It only existed to make these recordings. So far as I've been able to discover, the only time it ever actually got together and played outside of a studio was for some kind of a department store opening. They did not, you know, when Armstrong was playing in the evenings with his own band, it was a different group. He sometimes played in a pit orchestra. But the Hot Fives and Hot Sevens was a recording unit. And it's because those records were distributed so quickly and heard by so many people so fast that they had an instant and international impact, so that within 2 or 3 years you had musicians literally all over the world trying to play this music.
Gary Giddens, we're going to be going out soon. We're going to hear What Did I Do to Be So Black and Blue, but it's only fair. Tell us the other musicians who are in this, the Five and the Seven.
Oh, well, Johnny Dodds was the clarinetist in the original group. He was replaced by a less interesting player named Jimmy Strong. Kid Ory was originally on trombone. For the Hot Sevens, he had Baby Dodds on drums and Pete Briggs on tuba. The great figure in the Hot Seven besides Armstrong, the great Hot Fives and Hot Sevens, is pianist Earl Hines.
Of course.
And then also Don Redman, who wrote some marvelous arrangements, including the one that we just heard, Hot Like This. In terms, you know,
that's
these
the heart
are good
of the game.
New Orleans musicians for the most part, mm-hmm. except for Hines and Redman, but Armstrong is always the primary, you know, point of interest.
And where did he go after Hot Fives and Hot Sevens?
Well, he came to New York, and he had a very big personal triumph singing Ain't Misbehavin' in Hot Chocolates. He was such a showstopper that they took him out of the pit where he had been performing it and put him on the stage. And he made records of standards like I Can't Give You Anything But Love. And then he started doing things like Just a Gigolo and I Surrender Dear. And just, you know, he became one of the great interpreters of popular songs. But he showed that all of this material could be just as jazz-friendly as the blues or the original repertory that came out of New Orleans. That was one of the major innovations of Armstrong's early career.
Gary Giddens, thank you for taking us back to those 1920s, those incredible days, the Hot Fives and Hot Sevens. It's been great talking with you tonight.
My pleasure.
Gary Giddens is columnist for the Village Voice. He's author of Satchmo, The Genius of Louis Armstrong and Bing Crosby, A Pocket Full of Change. We're going to go out listening to What Did I Do to Be So Black and Blue. Coming up, Jack Beatty and I look back on the news of the week. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds from this past week.
We have much to be confident about in America. Yet our economy and our country need one more kind of confidence. Confidence in the character and conduct of all of our business leaders.
The Washington Post and New York Times both report that back in the 1980s, President Bush got two low-interest loans from a Texas oil company where he was a director, just the kind of arrangement he suggested should end in a Wall Street speech this week.
The suit is without merit, and as you indicate, this is a suit filed vis-a-vis Halliburton, and it's appropriate to address any further questions to Halliburton.
As investors continued their stampede away from stocks, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed below 9,000 for the first time since October. The NASDAQ Composite Index and the S&P 500 both fell to new five-year lows.
You cannot transport nuclear waste safely. We know that. Nuclear waste is subject to terrorist attack because of September 11th. We're talking about tens of thousands of truckloads and thousands and thousands of trainloads, and now they've told us they're going to move things on barges. This is a road that shouldn't be traveled.
I personally want that pilot to have a lethal weapon on board. If I have a terrorist trying to take my ship, I want to have a lethal weapon in my hand. I want to make sure that person doesn't even have a chance.
I have served as mayor since April of 1997, and I must say the police department has done an outstanding job. Now, with that in mind, I will not, under any circumstances, tolerate the type of conduct that I observed on the videotape.
This is not the way I wanted this to end, and I am saddened by it, but I think somebody who asked the question earlier, this is one of those rare situations where they legitimately ran out of players. And frankly, as I sat the last half inning desperately trying to come up with something, and that's why I asked to talk to Joe and Bob again, frankly, I couldn't think of an option at that point. You know, everything was done.
I'm sure you have been told that AIDS is killing more people than were killed by all the past wars in history and natural disasters put together. AIDS is a war against humanity.
And there is a week President Bush speaking out on corporate responsibility. The Washington Post and New York Times reporting that the president himself received sweetheart loans in the 1980s. A shareholder lawsuit filed against Vice President Dick Cheney. Dow Jones dives below 9,000. Senate approves nuclear waste going to Yucca Mountain, Nevada. The House approves, and we heard there from Transportation Committee Chairman Don Young saying he wants pilots, America's commercial airline pilots, armed with lethal weapons. The mayor of Inglewood, California, reacting to a videotape arrest that was shown all over TV news last week with a police officer slamming a handcuffed teenager's head onto a patrol car. Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig talking around and through the All-Star Games call and Nelson Mandela calling AIDS a war against humanity. Jack Beatty, a little too rich a week there almost.
Yeah, it was. It was beneath the week, of course, progress toward a comprehensive reform of corporate accounting and other aspects of other problems raised by the Enron scandal.
The Senate moving right ahead. Well ahead at this point of George Bush.
You're way ahead, and so are the House Republicans. They're getting the message. They're joining the team, and so I think that's very encouraging. I think all Americans should be encouraged that the system seems to be working. Unfortunately, the president doesn't seem to quite get it, and his biography now is intersecting really embarrassingly with the news, I think.
but it has the feeling of a week with the Dow going where it's gone and the Senate moving on the way America does business that could look like some kind of historical turning point when we look back in a few years.
It could indeed, and it's interesting to see that whether the president softens some of the bill. He's talked about that. The administration is distancing itself from some of the aspects of the Senate bill. It's really going to be telling. But the president yesterday said to a group in Milwaukee, you know, the bottom line in this corporate America stuff, is that important? Is that important?
Well, the tension here, Jack, seems to be between a country that doesn't entirely want to believe that it's off the gilded lily pad, and on the one hand, and on the other hand, maybe a time when things really are changing, whether people want to wake up to that or not.
Yes. Yes, well, of course, it'll all come down to market confidence. I want to be there when the Senate bills pass in its toughest form and then see whether the market revives. But, you know, all sorts of questions hanging over the Bush situation now. They're in a panic, according to the Globe, about Halliburton with the vice president. Questions. And then there are the Enron partners. We don't know yet who those partners are. This is going to come out. Is Cheney a partner? Is Karl Rove a partner? Lawrence Lindsay a partner?
You mean silent partners in Enron, Jack?
Partners in their partnerships. There are about 1,000 people we don't yet know about, and I think that's one of the, you know, that's out there.
We don't have a parliamentary democracy. The president will carry these things most likely through his term, whatever they are.
He will, and he's going to have to deal with them, and he could begin with dealing with them by firing his Secretary of the Army, Thomas White, who, you know, was up to his neck. Was an Enron executive who, like Bush in his own dealings, was a kind of upward failure, and who generated about $500 million in phony profits. He's still on the job. Is that what Mr. Bush means when he talks about accountability?
And then from Barcelona, Spain, that wise and wizened voice of Nelson Mandela reminding us that AIDS has now, he says, killed more people than all wars combined, and calling it a war on humanity.
Boy, that really steps up to it, doesn't it? Huh? And we had a program on this last week on how this is really now a security issue. You're having a generation of policemen, of teachers, of economic actors being decimated by this plague. Just frightening.
And Jack, pistol packing pilots make you feel better or not?
You know, I don't have a dog in that hunt. I mean, apparently they used to be armed. I didn't even know that. Did you know that?
Well, I didn't, but I don't like to think of a gun on board.
No, I don't really.
Well, but maybe we need it, and I'm sorry to say that. Jack, have a great weekend.
And you too, Tom.
On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakravarti, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Chris Bonacci. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is W.